Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past few years, microlending has received widespread attention and acclaim. You've probably heard of institutions like Kiva and Grameen Bank. Just today, Forbes is running a piece called Microfinance as a Tool to Alleviate Poverty. Here's how it works. Investors and lenders provide microfinance institutions with money at reasonable interest rates. Microfinance institutions then lend to the poor at much higher rates for shorter terms in small chunks. Microloans began in the 60s and 70s with Acción International in Venezuela and Nobel Peace Prize winner Muhammad Yunus's Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. Today, microlending is a $70 billion industry with hundreds of for-profit and non-profit institutions operating in countries around the globe. 200 million people now receive microfinance loans. They're often celebrated for pulling people out of poverty. But today's guest argues that with few exceptions, microfinance is doing more harm than good. In his new book, Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor, Hugh Sinclair argues that microfinance has been hijacked by profiteers and it needs to be reclaimed for the poor. He writes, quote, "The problem is not with a few rogue operators, but with systemic flaws that permeate the sector." Hugh Sinclair has worked in microfinance with a number of global organizations, banks, and funds for over a decade. He currently consults on microfinance strategy and portfolio management. Previously, he worked in traditional finance at ING Barings, CDC Capital Partners, and BZW, all of these letters, securities. And Hugh Sinclair is joining me here in studio. Hi, Hugh. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
It's great to have you. And I should say that we did invite Kiva, which is based in San Francisco, but they were not able to join us.
Yes.
But we will be joined at 10:30 by Juliana Carnia. She is director of Zedisha. That is the first peer-to-peer microlending service to offer direct interaction between lenders and borrowers. So, Hugh, this is quite an explosive book.
Yes, it's been quite controversial. It's really the first insider account where someone has directly challenged not just a few isolated operators, but some of the systemic flaws that permeate the entire sector.
And before the show, you told me that not one microlending institution has issued any statement based on your book.
No, so far the book has been out for about 6 weeks, and not a single one of the institutions mentioned in the book has made a single press release, a single comment, a single denial even. I think it's fair to say that they're probably seeking legal advice and that they are basically in a lockdown now, just hoping this will all blow over.
So before we dive in and talk about your argument, why don't we talk about microfinance? As I said, just today, Forbes is running a story with the headline, Microfinance as a Tool to Alleviate Poverty.
Yes, well, I mean, we're familiar with the traditional image of microfinance. Give a woman a small loan at a reasonable interest rate, she buys a goat, and with that goat she is able to repay the loan, get out of poverty, and because she repaid the loan, it can be recycled to the next person. So this is the sort of the mantra, the belief of the sector. And this is what reaches Americans and Europeans, their investors on the websites. They see these nice pictures and they're convinced that this is a worthy cause. And there are cases of microfinance really working. However, the reality, if you look into the details of microfinance, is that large parts of the capital never actually make it to any sort of enterprise whatsoever. A large part of it is simply consumed or used to repay loans from other microfinance institutions. And then if we stand back and look at the academic evidence of what has really been the impact on poverty, it's far from convincing. Most people conclude that the impact is basically zero.
Now, you say a few shining examples. Can you give us numbers? Because microlending is a $70 billion industry. You write that there are hundreds of profit and nonprofit institutions. Do you have any idea how many there actually are?
It's very difficult because the level of transparency in the microfinance sector is extremely low. So it's very difficult to even find out how many institutions there are.
And I didn't know that there's no regulation.
There are pockets of regulation. But the reality is that in most developing countries, the regulations don't really extend to the microfinance sector, which is why you see so many abuses in the poorer, you know, less regulated countries. But while people talk about regulation in Africa, in Latin America, and in Asia, less people talk about regulation in the United States and Europe, which is where most of the money comes from. And what's unusual is that actually, when you make a loan, when a US citizen invests in Citi Microfinance, Deutsche Bank Microfinance, Standard Chartered, or Grameen Foundation, USA, Calvert, any of these sorts of institutions, including Kiva, in practice, this is completely and utterly unregulated. There's no regulator looking over the shoulder of these people and actually making sure that what they're doing, in reality, they may claim that they're SEC regulated, but the reality is that the SEC doesn't pay any attention to what's really going on. So it's completely unregulated.
So you're making very strong arguments in this book. Tell us a little bit about how you got to this place.
Well, I'd been working in the microfinance sector for about 10 years, and actually from the beginning I began to notice that the myth, the image that had initially lured me into joining the sector wasn't quite as true as I thought. So I thought, well, maybe I'm working in one particularly questionable institution. So I worked in another one. I then moved to Mozambique and worked in an institution there. And I noticed that there were sort of systemic problems. But I thought, well, maybe if I go and work for the investment community, one of these specialised investment funds, then the experience that I have will help them to be able to make wise decisions in how to invest in good institutions and bad institutions. So maybe naively that was my theory. And then what I found, to my horror, is actually the microfinance investment funds also have warped incentives. They don't necessarily want to do the most that they can to alleviate poverty because it's less profitable for them. And because they also control the flow of information back to their ultimate investors in the US, you know, pensioners, savers, they can just provide a few nice photographs on a website and send them a newsletter with a few women with goats and sewing machines on the front cover. And everyone believes it and keeps on sending the money. So they basically operate with complete impunity.
When we visualize microfinance institutions, like you said, we see those photos, and we tend, at least I tend, to think of it as a very small sort of savings and loan bank. But you write that large commercial banks have entered the sector, lured by the whiff of profit and the appearance of social responsibility.
Yes, the days of the small, struggling NGO with 1,000 clients, they still exist, but really the sector is now coming to be dominated by local commercial banks moving into the microfinance space, or that these NGOs have grown so large that they themselves have effectively been privatised. They've converted from NGO to private limited company, and obviously at which point they have private shareholders and they can start making some serious returns. So the romanticised image has slightly been replaced. If we look at there's a report that comes out once a year called the Banana Skins Report. It surveys what are the biggest challenges in the sector. The number one risk currently facing the entire microfinance sector is over-indebtedness, which is to say, it's not that there isn't enough microfinance and we need more, it's that the poor have got so many debts that they're now running into precisely the same problems that we're familiar with in the United States and in Europe. This is the principal problem right now.
Well, and this was kind of shocking. You write that this book is dedicated to the poor entrepreneurs struggling to create a better world for themselves and their families, but in particular to those paying interest rates of over 100% a year to line the pockets of a few microfinance banks and their investors. How common is it to charge over 100% interest?
Well, it's very difficult to work out what the average is in the entire planet because, of course, A, no one reports their interest rates, and B, they have a big incentive to hide their interest rates because often they are somewhat ashamed of them. But, you know, there are ways that you can find it out on an individual basis. So I can't say to you the average rate in the world is X. But, I mean, interest rates of approaching 100% are very, very common. Over 100% is fairly common in parts of Latin America, particularly Mexico, and in large parts of Africa. When you take into account all the fees and the forced savings and the commissions and all the costs, the overall rate can add up quite quickly. So it's not really surprising that people get over-indebted. If we look at the case of the Banco Compartamos, the Mexican bank, they were recently found by David Rudman of the Center for Global Development in DC analyzed their interest rates and calculated that the rates can reach as high as 195% per year, as measured by an annual effective interest rate, which is what we would use in the United States. So you're talking about not just slightly high interest rates, but interest rates where it's difficult to really expect any normal human being to be able to repay those.
The Huffington Post has a review of your book, and I read the comments section, and that's where a lot of people are kind of surprised by what you're revealing, but they're also questioning the 100% interest rate number, saying that's not true. The institutions I've worked with have charged maybe 20% to 40%.
No, I mean, there are institutions that charge those sorts of rates. I mean, the famous one is Grameen Bank, the Nobel that won the prize with Muhammad Yunus in 2006. They charge, I think it's about 24%. And there are plenty of institutions that charge reasonable rates. If you look at a country such as Ecuador, which is tightly regulated, it's illegal to charge an interest rate over 30%, 30.5 I believe it is. So there are many cases of this. However, if you look at certain countries in Africa, for example, in Nigeria, there's one institution that I look at. They were charging rates that range from, I think it's 115 to up to 144% interest. Now, those interest rates were clearly published by independent rating agencies, MicroRate based in DC and Planet Rating based in France. They did four ratings in total and confirmed what the actual interest rates were. The New York Times went down to this institution in Nigeria and discovered that the interest rates were, I think it was 126%, doing their own independent calculations. And then there is a US based NGO called MF Transparency, and their sole purpose in life is to calculate the real interest rates. And they went down and discovered that the maximum interest rates were 144%. So we had five, six separate pieces of evidence confirming these interest rates. So it does make it rather hard to deny it. Now, are they an outlier? Well, it's difficult to know because we can't get generalized statistics. But I think, I mean, I would say it's an average interest rate of 50% is probably closer to the truth.
We are speaking with Hugh Sinclair. He's out with a new book called Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. Hugh has spent 10 years in the microfinance world and says that microfinance institutions are doing more harm than good. Microlending is a $70 billion industry. 200 million people now receive microfinance loans. There's so much talk about microfinance. It's widely praised for pulling people out of poverty. If you've given money to a microfinance institution that then turns around and lends your money to someone living in poverty, we'd love to hear from you. What was the experience like? Do you know how that particular institution works? And what questions do you have? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We did invite Kiva to join us. They were not available. We will be joined in about 10 minutes by Julia Kurnia. She's director of Jadisha, the first peer-to-peer microlending service. If you work in this industry, in the microfinance industry, we'd love to hear from you. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. The other thing, Hugh, is you detail what really goes on behind the scenes in these institutions. And you say that when you're talking about management, it's just a total mess. So, for example, you write about the Lift Above Poverty Organization in Nigeria. You describe it as being, quote, totally dysfunctional, uncontrolled, unmanaged chaos run by people with limited understanding of the absolute basics of finance and charging the poor astonishingly high interest rates in excess of 100%. How common is this, and can you give us some details?
Well, it depends on the region and the country. A lot of institutions based in Mexico are now actually becoming quite professional because the level of education is relatively good, the level of regulation is quite good, and there's a fair bit of competition, so there is actually good management. But in some regions in lesser developed countries, poor management is absolutely one of the most serious problems. Now, if we look at that institution, for example, when I first went there, they hadn't really come to grips with the concept of compounding interest rates, which is a financial term essential in banking and taught in the most basic of an economics class. we found out that although they were processing millions of transactions every day because of the number of clients they had repaying so frequently once a week, that they didn't really have a functioning IT system for processing, you know, tens of millions of transactions. The software that they had acquired was, I think, just over half the licenses were in fact pirated. They hadn't actually acquired them at all. So they were using illegal pirated software very poorly to manage huge sums of money. So needless to say, there was no internal control, absolutely no idea what was really going on. And family members, this is also quite typical, family members operating in senior management. I believe it was the brother of one of the managers was actually the external auditor of all the positions where you really ought to have someone vaguely independent. It's an unusual position to put your brother into. So this is quite common. The thing about this institution was that it was extremely profitable. And as a result of that profit, it was able to attract big investors. So we had, in the US, we had Citi, Standard Chartered, Deutsche Bank, and of course we had Grameen Foundation USA, Calvert Foundation, and of course Kiva. At that point, before Kiva eventually realised what was going on and pulled out of Lapo, it was the biggest single partner of Kiva. Kiva had pumped in an impressive $5 million into this institution with really very, very little idea what was happening.
So do you think that maybe some of these organisations like Kiva will get involved because they have a nice glossy brochure without really knowing what's going on behind the scenes?
I think that's completely accurate, yeah. So long as they can get nice photos onto the website, and that will attract more money into, you know, the company, such as Kiva, one of these microfinance funds, whichever intermediary it is. And so long as they can get the money down to the developing country and the money comes back with enough photos and nice little stories, I don't think really anyone asked too many questions. So if you look, for example, at the Kiva website, a simple question would be, what is the interest rate that my money is going to be lent out at? Now, Kiva can show you a photograph, they can tell you a nice little story about the woman, what she's going to do with the money, they can tell you all these things, but they can't actually tell you what the interest rate is. Everything else apart from the interest rate. The closest they're able to get to telling you an interest rate is a statistic which they quote, for no one really understands why, called the portfolio yield, which is an easily manipulated statistic, self-reported by the bank itself. It's not verified by anyone independent. It's posted on a website called The Mix Market, and it's generally 1 or 2 years out of date and doesn't really have a particularly close meaning to an interest rate. And yet this is the data that Kiva copy from The Mix Market and put onto their website and claim is something like an interest rate. So that's the closest you can get. Now, my question is, if you can get the photograph, the amount of money that the woman wants, a little story about her life, how long she's going to repay the loan, what she's going to do with it, if you can get all this information, why can't they just tell you what the interest rate is?
Well, for example, I'm looking at the Kiva website, and again, Kiva was not available to come on the show today, and they're highlighting a woman, Alma, from the Philippines. A loan of $600 helps Alma to buy groceries, toiletries, and beverages to sell and to pay for maintenance of her sewing machine. 16% raised, $500 to go. You can lend her $25 at a time. And there's a long story about Alma's life, and you're right, there's no information about... There's a lot of information here about loans. Interest and fees are charged, yes. Average loan, 5.7%. I don't think there's information here specifically on interest rates.
Yes. You can find out her entire life story, but you can't find out the interest rate. Had you picked a woman from... currently, Kiva's most expensive partner, I believe, is BRAC in Sudan. Their portfolio yield is 88%. Now, that doesn't translate directly to an interest rate, but that is the highest, what appears to be the highest current interest rates charged by a Kiva partner.
So is your main problem with a group like a non-profit, because Kiva is a non-profit, right? Is the main problem with them the fact that they don't reveal the interest rate?
Well, no, there's a number of other questions about Kiva. I mean, for example, if you look into the IRS 990 forms, which as a 501c not-for-profit, it is legally obliged to file, you see that the cash buffer, the money which they hold on behalf of clients that has never left California, is, I believe, by the end of 2010, which was the last year that the data is available, they had total cash of $42 million. And obviously, when you sign, when you accept the terms and agreements of Kiva, one of the clauses states that all money that is sitting in this current, in this bank account accumulates to Kiva. You forego your right to earn interest, even on your money when it's sitting in America. And if you look at the Kiva accounts and the notes of the accounts, which are available on their website, sure enough, you can see there's a comment which says Kiva is able to earn all this interest according to the user terms and acceptances. But then there are even more fundamental questions: is, you know, why is Kiva, or why has Kiva been doing loans to companies, to entrepreneurs that invest in cockfighting and coca leaf production, coca leaf vending? These are actually prohibited under California state law. You're not allowed to invest in cockfighting. It's considered animal cruelty. And yet, because Kiva is unregulated, it's able to lend to really whatever it wants. And actually, when a group of Kivans, the people who use Kiva, set up a group called Kivans Against Cockfighting and try to campaign for Kiva to at least stop providing money to entrepreneurs involved in animal cruelty, Kiva's response was, who are we to judge if it's socially acceptable in Mexico or Peru to have animals, you know, kill each other for entertainment? Then why it is not our position to judge this? Technically, it's true, because under California state law, as a 501c, it doesn't have to obey the cockfighting laws. And the IRS, of course, who does regulate the 501c companies, doesn't go into the sufficient detail to have a look at if its NGOs are providing money for coca leaf vending and cockfighting.
Again, Kiva is based in San Francisco. They make loans to people around the globe for as little as $25. They call themselves the world's first online lending platform, connecting lenders to entrepreneurs, and they were not available to come on today's show. You know, again, I'm looking at their website, at least 15 photos of people around the world. There's a man, Wafa, in Jordan. A loan of $1,400 helps him increase the quantity of kitchenware he has to sell. So these people would say, if it weren't for groups like Kiva, we wouldn't get loans, period.
Well, they might say that, but I mean, first of all, we have to ask some more fundamental questions, is how do you actually know that that person actually exists and is receiving the loans? Yeah, and is using the loans for that purpose. I'm not saying that they're not, but what are the actual protection mechanisms in place that ensure that that is actually what's happening? Yeah, because there have been cases reported, even reported by Kiva organisations, Kiva supporters, of some very questionable photographs. There was one pair of photographs which was two women claiming to have a hairdresser. And if you look at the photographs, you can see that not only are the two hairdressing salons totally identical, the same sellotape holding the hairdryer together, the same little items on the back shelf, and then these two nice little stories about how they're raising money. But the photographer forgot to remove the time and date stamp off the photograph, and you can actually see that the two photographs were taken 55 seconds apart. And this is on kivafriends.org. This was actually flagged by a Kivan who said, this is a little bit strange, isn't it? How come these two apparently separate institutions that look absolutely identical had their photos taken 55 seconds apart? So, I mean, there are some very fundamental questions related to these peer-to-peer organizations.
We're speaking with Hugh Sinclair, author of the new book, Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. Hugh spent 10 years in microfinance in different countries. We'll talk more with him about where the profits actually go. And if you work in microfinance, if you've given to an institution, what are your thoughts on Hugh's arguments? What questions do you have? Do you know how the institutions actually work? 866-798-8255. And after a break, we'll be joined by one institution. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Hello. Hello, this is Chuck Finney of Your Legal Rights. We're having a Call a Lawyer night this Wednesday evening starting at 7. If you have legal questions for off the air, please call 1-800-525-9917. On the air, on Your Legal Rights, the topic will be social networking issues in the workplace. My guests will be employment law attorneys Tyler Patko and Olga Savage. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 for Call a Lawyer night and Your Legal Rights here at 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our new newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with Nancy Mullane about her new book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. How are people who've served time for murder reintegrating into society? That is tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we will open the lines and we'd love to hear from you to get your reaction to how the United States government is responding to the mass shooting in Aurora, Colorado. How does the response in the U.S. compare to responses around the globe when something similar, unfortunately, happens? That's Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's show about microfinancing and how this industry works, over the past couple of years, we've heard so much about microloans, often talked about as pulling the poor out of poverty. In fact, Forbes is running a story today called Microfinance as a Tool to Alleviate Poverty. Microfinance institutions offer loans of as little as $25 to people who would otherwise be turned away by most banks. Microlending is a $70 billion industry with hundreds of for-profit and nonprofit groups operating around the globe. 200 million people now receive microfinance loans. But today's guest, Hugh Sinclair, says that microfinance has been hijacked by profiteers and it needs to be reclaimed. Hugh Sinclair is out with a new book called Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. And if you have any questions about how this industry works, if you work for a microfinance institution, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post on our website, yourcallradio.org. And before we get to our next guest, let's actually take a call from someone who works with a microlending institution, Eric Weaver, calling from Opportunity Fund in San Jose. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on. And hello to Mr. Sinclair. I wanted to applaud you for doing a really thorough and a thorough and accurate portrayal of a lot of what's going on in the sector, because I do think tons of money has flowed into international microfinance with, like you say, very little regulation and a lot of negative things have occurred. I did want to just make a really quick plug for local micro lending as practiced here in the Bay Area in California, and say that the way we do it here in the U.S. is really quite different. Partly because we are regulated. We are regulated by the state of California, and Opportunity Fund, the largest micro lender in California, charges the highest rate. We charge is 12%, and with a 5% loan fee, so you get a rate of 17% on a 1-year loan. And we verify absolutely that all of the loans are for a business purpose, and we are pretty careful about making sure that we believe that the loan's going to do more harm than good. So it can be practiced responsibly, and as Mr. Sinclair points out, that often will mean that you're not making as much profit or any profit, but there is a valid reason to use this strategy as a way of helping create jobs and economic activity in low-income communities.
And Eric, I just did a quick search. So you're the CEO of this group, Opportunity Fund.
Yes. I founded the organization back in 1994. And we started doing this before we'd ever heard of Muhammad Yunus or microfinance or anything else. We have, to some degree, adopted the language of microfinance, frankly, because it's been helpful with fundraising. but it, with some of the things that have happened overseas in recent years, I think, you know, we are always questioning whether it's a word we should be using or not using. You know, it's a way to connect with people because they've heard about it, but then what we do is often very different.
So, Eric, just quickly, what do you think about Hugh's arguments about this industry losing its way?
I think they're mostly true. I mean, I think there are plenty of mostly smaller institutions that still are very much mission-driven and are doing good things for people. But I think that he's right that, you know, largely just driven by the sheer amount of investment dollars that have flowed into this, a lot of people around the world have, you know, seen an opportunity to make a quick buck and have, and I think a lot of investors have frankly, like they check their brains at the door when they hear the word microfinance and they think, oh, this is so good and, you know, this is, it's, we're doing well by doing good and we can get people out of poverty and make a profit. And, you know, I just, like, there are ways to help people get out of poverty by making a profit and it's called, like, business and creating jobs. But I don't think consumer lending, which is a lot of what microfinance is, really helps people get out of poverty. I do think if you can lend money to someone who's got a productive use for it and can afford to pay the interest, they're going to have a higher return, you know, on their business activity than what the interest costs. It can be a good thing, but you've got to really sift through the potential borrowers to find those people and not just lend to anyone who shows up.
You?
Yeah, Eric, I think you raised some very interesting points there. The fact that you're lending at 17% interest rates, you know, that might still seem a lot to some people who are struggling to pay a mortgage, but when you put that into perspective with microfinance, I mean, that is globally low. That is astonishing. So Kiva also recently announced that they're going to start doing loans to people in Los Angeles, and they suggested that the rates would be 8.5%. Now, what I found unusual about that is, why is it that U.S. citizens can get a loan from Kiva at 8.5%? If you look at the institutions that Kiva charge, that Kiva works with in Mexico, just because you're south of the border, you pay an interest rate of 85%. 85% is one of their institutions. That's the average interest rate that the institution charges. So it raises a really interesting question. If you can do these sorts of operations in the United States at these reasonable interest rates, why really do we need to charge the Mexicans 10 times more than we charge the people who just happen to be U.S. citizens? Of course, you mentioned that the reason is because it's regulated in the United States. And when you discuss the issue of the profitability, the funding just flowing into the sector. I mean, let's not forget the famous case of Acción, the US-based NGO. They did a $1 million investment into the bank Compartamos, which I mentioned earlier charges interest rates of up to 195% per year. If you actually look at the profit that they made on that investment when they did the IPO, the stock market flotation, some years later, that $1 million became $270 million. So we're talking a level of return that attracts a huge number of people, including, of course, our friends on Wall Street, who suddenly smelt that whiff of profit and realized there's a billion people out there, they're unregulated, we can charge them what we want, and no one's looking over our shoulder. So it really shouldn't come as much of a surprise that this profit incentive has permeated the sector. And it's I would go as far as to say it's even worse. When you've got a genuinely socially motivated NGO that is desperately trying to actually have an impact in these countries, the problem is that they are competing with the sharks. And it's very easy for them to actually be driven out of the market. It's not just that there are only a few good institutions, it's that those good institutions can barely raise money from anyone, and they are getting destroyed by very, very aggressive local competitors who are coming in with very different ideals and are actually driving them out of the market. So I applaud the work that you're doing, and I just sincerely hope that at some point we can get that kind of work actually more typical in the developing world.
And Eric, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Where do you provide loans?
We provide loans now throughout the Bay Area and in Los Angeles. And we actually are a partner with Kiva, although we're not working with them in Los Angeles at this point. I want to just make one more comment and I'll go, is that there's actually a really simple answer to Hugh's question about why we're able to do it here and they're not doing it there. It's not simply regulation. I want to be upfront. We're not a profitable institution. We raise donor dollars to be able to do this. And the institutions that many of the ones that Kiva works with and that, you know, you're talking about are very much, you know, seeking to make a profit or, you know, break even or better, if we were trying to break even or better doing what we do in the U.S., we would need to charge interest rates probably in the, you know, 50% range. Mm. We don't do that, both because of regulation, because we don't think it's good for clients. So it is true that without significant donor dollars, you couldn't operate microfinance in most countries at the scale that it's being operated. But I think Sally Hughes' argument is partly that it shouldn't be operating at the scale that it's operating because people are over-indebted. So I just want to make that distinction so we're not misleading anyone about how our business model works.
Well, thank you for calling in. Hugh, what are your thoughts on that argument?
Well, the problem with that argument, I think it's valid. The problem is do we therefore conclude that fair-priced microfinance is not a viable business model? And if that is the conclusion, then we have a very, very serious problem on our hands. There are cases of institutions. If you take, for example, Ecuador, there are institutions that are charging well under 30% and are able to make a reasonable profit and cover their costs and return some, you know, they're for-profit, shareholder-driven companies, and they are able to make a small return on equity for their shareholders. So I don't know if you'd need to charge 50%, but certainly there are institutions charging 25% that can make a few percentage points of return on equity for their investors. And if the investors are happy with that, that's fine. But if the investors say, well, we can either make 2 or 3% return on equity if we charge this interest rate, or we can make a 100% return on equity if we quadruple the interest rates, and we can get away with it, it's very tempting to gradually not just seek to break even and make a reasonable profit, but to make an astronomical profit. And I think that's where the temptation seeps in.
All right. Well, thanks again for calling in, Eric. That's Eric Weaver calling in. He's the CEO of the Opportunity Fund. And since 1995, they've deployed over $220 million in the Los Angeles area and the Bay Area. And today we are speaking with Hugh Sinclair. He's out with a new book called Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. And if you've ever given money to a micro lending organization, we'd love to hear from you. Do you know where your money was spent or how your money was spent? Do you know how the institution works? If you have any questions about this massive $70 billion industry, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What do you think about Hugh's arguments? And if you work in the industry, we would love to hear your experience. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And tonight I'll be interviewing Hugh at the Hillside Club, 2286 Cedar Street in Berkeley. It starts at 7:30, and you can find more information at our Your Call Facebook page. And now I would like to welcome Julia Kurnia to the show. Julia is director of Zedisha, the first peer-to-peer micro-lending service to offer direct interaction between lenders and borrowers. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, okay, Julia. Let's see. We're going to see how your line is. First of all, can you talk to us about how Zedisha operates?
Sure.
You know, Julia, we're actually going to have to give you a call right back. We have you on a pretty bad line. Let's go to our next caller. We've got Marty in San Francisco on the line. Hi, Marty. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, brothers and Mr. Sinclair.
Hello.
I just wanted to call in and talk a little bit about a student club at a high school where I teach. They call themselves, or we call ourselves, the Hillsdale Effect. Our high school is Hillsdale in San Mateo, and for the last 4 years, students on campus have raised each year $5,000 through some kind of consciousness-raising activities and fundraising activities and some car washes and all the traditional kind of suburban fundraising tactics to make microloans in Antigua, Guatemala. And this past June, I took a group of 8 students along with another teacher to Antigua, and we were able to meet the women themselves who received these loans, and we were able, very fortunate, to participate in the very final night of financial literacy classes that the women are required to take in order to receive their loans. And so the very first night we went, we went up onto a hillside above Antigua into a community that is very literally carved out of the hillside and very flood prone, to a very humble dirt floored home of a woman, and there were six or eight other women there, and they were about to receive, all of them living between $2 and $5 a day, about to receive their loan. And my students, those who I advise, were really fortunate to be there for that final class and to get to see them receive their loans. And then the next day we followed the regional program manager on her travels throughout the kind of local villages nearby to meet past clients. And one of the kind of unique things, we work with Namaste Direct.
And so it sounds like, Marty, you had a really mm-hmm. good experience with this.
We did, yeah. Absolutely eye-opening in a number of different ways. But we came away feeling, we've done this trip 4 years now. Each year the students fundraise both for the loans and for their travel. And being able to meet past recipients of loans that were funded at least in part by some of the work that my students do, came away with a real sense that the money is going truly into the hands of the women who are starting or continuing their small businesses.
And Hugh writes about this in detail.
I mean, I definitely believe that there are a large number of very good institutions. It's not to say that all microfinance is bad. But the question that I would have for Marty is, how did you identify the institution that you were working with in Guatemala? Do you invest directly in this institution, or do you go through an intermediary? Do you put your money in Kiva or something like this first, or is
no,
it direct?
We do. We came to know about Namaste Direct through a connection at San Mateo Rotary, a local business organization. And
Okay, well, I think that's a very important point, because for a lot of, I think, you're in a position of luxury that you can actually have that direct relationship, and you can go and do the analysis yourself, and you can ask what the interest rates are, and you can ask about the treatment of the poor clients. You can go and see people on site and actually see if this is really working or not. And I think when you're that level of proactivity is involved, microfinance is a lot more effective. The problem comes when we're sitting in California, we can't go to Guatemala, and we have to therefore trust an institution to take our money and invest it on our behalf. Because this is the question, is this institution in Guatemala, which I don't know, I must say, but if they are doing very effective ethical microfinance and charging reasonable interest rates, as you seem to be suggesting, then how attractive are they to the large microfinance investment funds? That is my question, because what I see repeatedly is that these really good institutions, they do exist. There's no doubt that they exist, and I discuss a number of them in the book. The problem is that they find it very difficult to grow and to scale, because people will put in $5,000, $10,000 here, but when they go to the big microfinance funds and say, we want $3 million because we want to go nationwide, the funds say, well, you know, to be honest, you're not very profitable and your competitor is a lot more profitable, so we're not really that interested in supporting you. So, unfortunately, these grassroots organizations just have difficulty taking off.
Well, thank you for calling in, Marty, with that story. And now I would like to welcome back Julia Kurnia to the show. Hopefully we have a better line. Julia is director of Jadisha. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Okay, much better. Thank you. So on your website, it says that you eliminate the middleman, ensuring that entrepreneurs' profits stay right where they belong in their communities. How does your model differ from others?
Sure. Well, Jadisha was founded to address the lack of transparency and especially the exorbitant interest rates that are prevalent in these intermediated lending platforms. So we're the only person-to-person micro-lending service that doesn't go through intermediaries. We target computer-literate, low-income individuals in developing countries, and they've passed a thorough background check, and then they're able to post their own loan applications, and they propose their own interest rates.
How does that work?
Well, if a borrower decides that they think an interest rate of 10% is reasonable, 10% quoted flat, for example, they can. Jadisha charges a transaction fee of 5% to cover our money transfer costs. So the minimum that, anyone pays is, just 5%. That's way lower than, the global average is, 40, 50%. So it's much lower. And on top of that, they can offer interest optionally to lenders at any rate they think is fair. And the average rate of interest offered to lenders is, just about 3%. So on average, the average borrower for a loan with Sedicia pays 8%. Their proposed interest rate is posted on their loan application, and the lenders can bid at that rate or they can bid at less. And they see exactly how much the borrower will be paying, and they can fund the loan at wherever they think is reasonable.
I think it's a very interesting model. Dare I ask, what sort of repayment rates do you get?
Sure. We've been operating for about 2 years, and it's not quite as good as Kiva's reported repayment rate. So far, we've had a repayment rate of 98%.
And Julia, you've been listening to the show. What are your thoughts about Hugh's overall argument about the microfinancing industry, that it's essentially lost its way and is actually betraying the poor?
Those are strong words, but I think there's a lot of validity in them. A fairly priced microfinance is a viable business model, but it needs to be done differently than it has been up until now.
And could I ask you, what is your reaction when you hear of institutions such as Compartamos charging rates of 195% in what is considered to be, one of the most famous coming-of-age institutions? The IPO of Compartamos proved that microfinance was now part of the grown-up financial sector, and it was sort of applauded at the time. How do you respond to those sorts of interest rates?
Well, people have traditionally tried to justify these high interest rates by saying, well, the transaction costs of these small loans are very high, and inflation rates are high, and all these reasons. And then they have these exorbitant profits going to a few people, or they have just plain inefficient operations with too many bricks and mortar offices and staff knocking at borrowers' doors every week to collect repayments. And all of that is not necessary. So Sedicia is founded on the premise that borrowers can make their own repayments, and they actually communicate with lenders directly. The website is a bit similar to Facebook, which has become very popular in Africa and developing countries recently. And the people who borrow loans on Sedicia are not the poorest of the poor, but they're very poor. They might have household incomes of $2 a day. And they access the internet just through local cyber cafes, and they talk to lenders, and it's very transparent.
Well,
they repay loans on their own.
And speaking of transparency, we have a listener email. What would the right kind of transparency and accountability actually look like, Hugh?
For a start, one of the things that I would suggest would be a good start on the peer-to-peer lending platforms is at least discussing interest rates and how the actual treatment of clients by the institution, and explaining what level of care is taken on site. Is there someone actually looking after these clients and actually making sure, for a start, that they exist? And what are the actual tangible measures, rather than just slapping a photo on the website? But if you look at the microfinance investment funds, it is astonishing how non-transparent they are. The vast majority of them don't even list the institutions that they've invested in. Forget the interest rates. You don't even know what institutions. They might break it down by region. So they've got a $250 million fund, and they'll say 25% went to Latin America, 50% went to Africa. That's it. You don't even know which institutions. When you say, where do you start with transparency? You start at ground zero. These people, you have to start, what did you actually do with the money? Where did it go? Which country? Which institution? And then you can start saying, well, how much of the money actually went to an entrepreneurial activity, and how much was simply a consumer loan? How much was actually just used for one poor person to pay off a loan from one institution to another and recycle the loans amongst institutions in a giant Ponzi scheme? But if you look at the microfinance investment funds, they will tell you, 100% of our money goes towards entrepreneurial activities. And yet you look at the academic research and they say a large part, possibly the majority of all microfinance, doesn't go anywhere near an entrepreneurial activity whatsoever. It's for consumption and repaying other loans. So, if we could just get some basic statistics like that, like how much actually went to a business at all, but they won't do it. They will not reveal they will not even mention that topic.
Have you requested this information?
Well,
when you say they won't do it, is anyone asking for this information?
No, I mean, the thing is that they have a vested interest in not allowing this information to come out. So even the academics, when they try to drill down into how much of your money is actually being spent on consumption, the thing is that the banks just say, oh, this is confidential client data, we're not going to give this out to you. So it's impossible to get the data. Yeah. It's very difficult.
And Julia, we've only got a couple minutes, but do you have anything else to add there?
Yes. You know, I'd encourage listeners to judge for themselves. They can check out our website. It's linked from the klw.org Your Call page today. And they can just see what the borrowers say that they're using the loans for and how they say it has benefited them in their own words.
We have an email from another listener who wanted to know, Hugh, what specific microfinance groups you worked with, and can you also name some groups that are doing good in this sector?
It's possibly not particularly wise to single out individual people. In the book, I do name a number of institutions that I've worked with, and these include, for example, in the US, World Relief, based in that was who I worked with in Mozambique. But I'm also very familiar with the work of Grameen Foundation. I've worked with some of the institutions that they've invested in, Calvert Foundation, and then quite a few of the Kiva partners.
We have two listeners who wanted your take on Accion, A-C-C-I-O-N, a micro-lending group in Bolivia.
Yes, I don't know specifically their Bolivia operations. Actually, Bolivia is one of the only countries in Latin America that I've never worked in. But Accion is, you know, somehow considered to be the benchmark of the neoliberal free market approach. The competition is the mantra of the day, and interest rates can be extremely high. They're the people really behind Compartamos. So Accion is an interesting institution because it divides the sector into the for-profit people and the for-poor people.
Well, and for the poor, since we are talking about the poor, you dedicate your book to the poor. Do you think that microloans are one answer to helping these people who live in countries where their own leaders are not really talking about the poor?
I think it's one tool amongst many tools that can be used for a subset of the poor, not for everyone. Not everyone is a budding entrepreneur that can benefit from microfinance. Some entrepreneurs can benefit from it, but by no means all, and we've overhyped it and we've gone too far.
Hugh Sinclair is author of Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor. And I'll be interviewing Hugh tonight at the Hillside Club over in Berkeley at 7:30. I also want to thank Julia Kurnia, director of Zadisha. Thanks, Julia, and thank you, Hugh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How are people who've served time for murder reintegrating into society? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Nancy Mullane, author of Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. California approved parole for 10% of murder cases last year, 80% under Governor Jerry Brown. What does rehabilitation look like? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Why are parole cases so rare and what happens after they're released? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. We'll be right back.